Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Monday, the 5th of January. When I signed up for this job many, many years ago, I was told the first show after a holiday would be boring. That nothing would happen. And that you would just kind of coast. And you could talk about stuff. You could talk about what you did. You're basically just idling for an hour and a half, just idling. Because there's really nothing to talk about. And so the first show of the year was Friday's show. And I quite frankly, didn't listen because I wasn't here. I was in Hawaii with my family. We were having a lovely time. So this show, I thought, would be just dead boring. Just idle. Nothing going on. I thought, well, that's great. And as I was flying in the middle of the night from Honolulu to Chicago, because that's a direct route, that then all of the stuff started to break loose. And then I became just entranced and transfixed in reading all about it and finding out what was going on. And that's still hard to do, finding out what's going on, because we really don't quite know what's going on. But what I did do, the first thing I did was I sent out a note to all of my smart panel friends and said, I need you on Monday to come in and to talk about this. And so here we are, and I'm very thrilled that all of these individuals are with us to talk about what indeed happened over the weekend, and we'll get into that in just a second. Let me introduce this group to you, and we will get started. We welcome to our proceedings Robert Brigham, Professor of History and International Relations at Vassar College, specialist on the history of U.S. foreign policy. I think that will come in handy today. Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, Joe. Thanks for having me.
It's really nice to have you on the program. Thank you so much. Jim Ketterer joins us, senior fellow, Bard College for Civic Engagement. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Very nice to have you here. Alexander Mihailovich, professor emeritus of Russian at Hofstra University and still at Middlebury.
Yeah.
And at Middlebury College, author of Illiberal Vanguard, Populist Elitism in the United States and Russia. Good morning.
Good morning. Good to be here during these very interesting times.
Indeed. And political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post joins us. Good morning, Libby. How are you?
I'm good.
All right. Okay. So here we go. We're gonna go for it. First of all, Happy New Year to everybody. I hope you had a beautiful holiday season. I hope you had a beautiful, you know, we're getting back to work today, all that stuff. So
I went back to work like the next day. Well, so just to be clear.
Well, goody for you.
Some of us work on January 2nd.
All right. That's fine. That's fine.
I mean, I know a lot of people.
I did not.
I know you didn't. A lot of people took the whole week off. And
No long weekend?
No. It's, you know, session starts.
Session starts, and your candidates were getting sworn in.
Yes, my candidates were getting sworn in, campaigns are starting at the end of February, so, you know, things are happening.
All right. Well.
But thank you for.
But you know. I'm still glad. Hopefully, through all of that, you were able to have a happy holiday season.
We did.
There you go.
It was very nice.
All right. Well, good. All right, let's talk about what happened. So we are now, depending on how you define it, and this seems to be the big question, the crux of this, which is we apparently are running Venezuela now, but we don't know what exactly that means. The Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, has said in some case that just means that we're trying to coerce them, which I don't know if that's a better word.
No.
Coerce, but okay. But the president then says, no, we're running the show. Okay. So all of this goes back to the early Saturday where the Nicolas Maduro taken from Venezuela, brought to the United States, where he has arrived at a Manhattan courthouse, and that is about to take place as we speak. Maduro now is the ousted Venezuelan leader and his wife. They are said to be arraigned on drug trafficking and other charges. And this comes as the president now continues. So all morning yesterday, and I don't want to get ahead of myself because I want to try to put this into some logical perspective. But yesterday, the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, spent most of the morning on the talk shows trying to get around what the president said, that we're running Venezuela. And as I said, instead used the word coerce. Well, then the president came out later and suggested that he could take action against other countries, too. Colombia, Mexico, Greenland. So, you know, it wasn't there are other places to coerce, I guess. So Maduro and his wife are now in the federal courthouse in Lower Manhattan ahead of their arraignment on charges of drug trafficking and other crimes 2 days after they were captured in a U.S. military raid in Caracas. Mr. Maduro and his wife were escorted off a helicopter in downtown Manhattan with heavy security and were set to face charges including narco-terrorism and conspiracy to import cocaine, according to an unsealed indictment. Their capture in a U.S. commando raid in Caracas on Saturday followed a months-long campaign by the Trump administration to drive out the autocratic leader. I know we'll get to this, but in some ways that this particular indictment had been worked on for a long time, like almost 10 years that they had been working on this. Even as Venezuela's interim leader, Delcy Rodriguez, offered to work with the United States, quote, on a cooperative agenda, President Trump on Sunday night doubled down on his assertion of direct control over Venezuela, saying that his government was, quote, in charge of the country. That contradicted comments hours earlier by Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who suggested that the administration would instead coerce cooperation from the new leader in Caracas. Mr. Trump also suggested that the United States could take action against more countries, including Colombia, Mexico, and the semi-autonomous Danish territory of Greenland. You take 2 weeks off. Asked whether that could mean a U.S. operation against Colombia, he said, "It sounds good to me." In response to Mr. Trump's comments in an earlier interview that we do need Greenland, the Prime Minister of Denmark, a NATO ally, urged him to stop the threats. So a lot of stuff that we can go over and a lot of directions that we can go in. I'm just going to mention a few of them and then we'll get the initial comments from our panel and then we'll dig deeper into several of these issues. One, congressional briefing. After Democratic lawmakers complained of being kept in the dark about U.S. plans for Venezuela, the Trump administration plans to provide a briefing on Monday afternoon to leaders in Congress. This was done without congressional approval, so we'll add that to the list. Security Council. The U.N. Security Council is scheduled to convene an emergency meeting on Monday to discuss the U.S. raid in Venezuela. So we have that to watch, to keep a watchful eye on as well. So what is this all about? Well, we'll get into that as well. Initially, of course, it was drugs. It was fentanyl. It was cocaine. And then the president made it quite clear during his remarks on Saturday morning that it was about, indeed, oil, which was sort of the thought all around, all along. But at least 16 oil tankers hit by U.S. sanctions appear to have attempted to evade a major American naval blockade on Venezuela's energy exports over the last 2 days, in part by disguising their true locations or turning off their transmission signals. Mr. Trump made clear his desire to open up Venezuela's vast state-controlled oil reserves to American oil companies. Shares of major American oil companies jumped on Monday in the first trading session since Maduro's ouster, but U.S. intervention in the Venezuelan oil industry could prove complicated. It could also prove to be quite expensive. So those are just some of the things that are in the works today as we take to the air at 9:21 on this Monday morning, the 5th of January. So let's go to our group and get their thoughts on what we should take from these developments. Bob.
Well, if a U.S. presidential administration ever learned from history, I would be out of a day job. The ability of the military to do a decapitation like this is extraordinary. My brother-in-law was part of the Panama raid that grabbed Noriega, and we talked all day yesterday about how efficient Delta Force was in this. But achieving a military tactical objective, a very limited military tactical objective, and running a country are two different things. And U.S. nation-building efforts since 1961 have been pretty much a disaster. And so I think the this administration in particular is ill-equipped for nation-building, for being a partner, for running a foreign country. And on top of that, everything that Trump and the Trump administration would need to put civil society back in place in Venezuela, to help put civil society back in place, if that's a goal at all, has been hollowed out. USAID, United States hasn't had an ambassador in Venezuela since 2019. And before that, there was a long stretch from 2010 where the U.S. had no diplomatic presence at all. So none of the pieces that the United States needs to have in place to do kind of any administrative work are there. I think that Trump is going to find out that it's a lot more difficult to have any influence on the political will inside Venezuela. 28 million people, it's a lot of people. The sectarian issues are not the same as they were in Iraq, but the population's about the same. But there are colectivos and other groups that are organized that will present problems for the United States. Just on the oil front, this is a disaster. Oil's going at $60 a barrel right now. Jim knows the OPEC side of this better than almost anybody. But, I mean, the last thing you would want is a weak dollar and a surplus of oil on the market. This is not at all what any kind of global strategy would lead to.
So I feel, I hate to interrupt, and I just feel that if I don't, I'm going to lose my train of thought and of different things that I want to talk about. But I don't want to take us off the eyes on the prize. But one of the things that the president kept on saying is the motive for this was to keep Americans safe. And when the question was brought up of, but what about the problems at home and dealing with, quote, America first, many in the MAGA movement upset about that very thing are then pointing to exactly what you just mentioned. And the answer that the administration has is, well, these oil companies in America now are going to just be flooded and they're going to be making so much money, which I have no doubt, but I don't see how that then, I apologize for the Reagan-esque
trickle
metaphor,
down.
But trickle down to the American public.
In fact, I think it's just the opposite.
Okay.
Chevron is the only U.S. oil company that's operating in Venezuela with a license right now. Everybody else is tied up in courts in Delaware. Mm. It's going to take a decade to rebuild the infrastructure, which is in bad need of repair in Venezuela, and to reclaim the kind of market share, 1%, they're thinking, maybe up to 2%. That's going to cost $7 billion a year. And in this political climate in Venezuela right now, what privately held oil company is going to jump in and invest in a market that's sinking? All projections are that oil demand globally is going to hit its peak within the next 2 years and then start to rapidly decline. So, I mean, I don't see the math in the economics. This is typical of the Trump administration to do back of the envelope economics when this is very complicated.
Alexander.
Well, if it's a decapitation, it's a kind of a pre-guillotine era form of decapitation. It's completely partial, messy, and it's also a kind of, I would say, personality cult perception of what political decapitation would be, because of course Maduro's party is still in place. That would be if that party was in some ways disempowered, then this is a serious conversation. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is only he has been taken out of place, and the nationalization of the oil resources in the country is something that his party has control of. If the oil resources are going to get denationalized, it has to happen through some kind of parliamentary procedure in Venezuela, which implicitly the Trump administration recognizes or hasn't thought of, really, it seems to me, because, you cannot simply seize those resources without in some ways changing radically the administrative infrastructure of the country, which the Trump administration has not thought of simply.
So when you think of these things that they haven't thought of, it does give you in one sense we're saying that we saw this coming for a long, long time. And yet little or no planning was done for what would happen after you do this, after you get Maduro. And I think another part of this, from what I have understood in following, is that while, just what I said, all of the beacons seem to show us that this was going to happen, and yet both in Washington, in Caracas, in Venezuela, people are shocked that it happened on Saturday morning. Jim.
Yeah, and we already see a confusion in Venezuela and in Washington. We see confusion in Venezuela because, as Alexander's saying, we have the Maduro people still in charge. We have the vice president, now the president, coming out and lambasting the U.S. intervention and then walking that back. One can only imagine the conversations with our interlocutors that led to that. I can imagine them exactly. Godfather 2, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And and you have the person who was, by all accounts, actually elected president in 2024, declaring himself president, though he's in exile. And you have the Nobel Prize winner, who really is the most popular opposition figure, who is out of the country, who most recent poll had her, close to 80% approval rating. And Trump has said she has no support of the people. You also have this confusion in Washington. You have the president saying one thing about what we're doing. We have Marco Rubio saying something else, trying to walk it back. And then the president saying on Air Force One last night when asked about this, well, you wouldn't want me to answer that. And then he answered it and he said, we're in charge. And I saw somebody post and he said, you're in charge of Venezuela. You can't even run the Kennedy Center. How is this going to work? But I just, if we have time, Joe, I just wanted to mention.
We have time. We're gonna we'll take our break later.
I just think it's useful to also put some of this in broader context. I think that's what we do here on the roundtable. And so for those people who are against this intervention and concerned by it. I think that you generally fall into the camp of people who still see U.S. foreign policy as part and parcel of the rules-based international order. Mm. That there is some semblance of multilateralism, that there are norms, there are principles, that there are international organizations that matter, that's international law that matters. Mm-hmm. And though there have been serious and noteworthy times when that has not been adhered to, that this has been a touchstone for U.S. national security strategy for both parties over many decades. Mm-hmm. With examples outside that we should definitely talk about today. But, what we see here is really a maximalist use of American power. I would say even taking the kind of roadmap that was put in place by the neoconservatives in the 20, 2003 invasion of Iraq has taken that and put it on steroids. Mm-hmm. And this unilateral use of American power, this also, you know, hyperpower of the executive, not consulting with Congress, not consulting really even with many of the relevant agencies within the U.S. government that would be normal to be consulted with, and using these kinds of powers, and then creating a justification and a narrative afterward to just kind of fill in the gaps. And when I hear these kinds of narratives, I think, well, are they just inept at doing foreign policy, or is it they simply don't care, or is it both? Mm. It's probably both. And so, you know, I think that context, and, you know, we can talk about some of the other examples that might be relevant, but I think the national security strategy that was released, this document a few weeks ago by this administration, is both kind of, you know, doubles down heavily on this maximalist unilateral approach, is also written in a way that seems very amateurish, almost kind of hallucinogenic. But you have to take them at their word. When they say these things, you have to believe it. It's not just rhetoric.
Well, that's exactly right, because it is it's all, well, not all, but most of it is proven to be to come to fruition, right?
Exactly.
I mean, and as wild as it may get, and as odd as it may get, it's still, you get there.
Yeah, and I just continue to run into people and have conversations with people who say, you know, I'm concerned that we might be headed down a bad path. You know, guess what, folks? We're way down that path.
Right.
We have arrived. Yeah, we're rocketing down that path.
I would just like to quickly interject here about the whole matter of, you know, neoconservatism. In many ways, this is a return to that, you know, sort of whole maximalist.
Right, which,
you know,
Trump said he was against.
Right. However, it seems to me that there's something else going on here, which is simply that whatever resources are available for a country that have nothing to do explicitly with defense, you know, concerns, those resources outside of sovereign territory can be accessed. They should be accessed. There's a sense of, well, it reminds me a little bit of, you know, there's a very good English novelist named Edward St. Aubin, who has this series of novels that are called the Patrick Melrose trilogy. And there, this is, you know, there's a, you know, a disaffected son of an aristocratic, you know, English family, and his father is this horrible Tory and child abuser. And one person at a dinner confronts him and says, well, why would you kill foxes? You're not going to eat the foxes. You no longer have a herd that the foxes would prey on. What is the point of that? And he says, what is the point? We kill them when we want to. There's a sense here of there are resources, we take them when we want to. And we don't need international agreements. We don't need any kind of coalition of people, other countries that are going to support our cause. This was kind of a staple of the neoconservative viewpoint. You know, NATO is important. Israel is important. All of these kinds of countries that, you know, in one way or the other support a kind of, you know, global order of free trade is very important. All of that is out the window now, it seems to me.
Of all things, when I was listening to the president from Air Force One last night, and I was thinking to myself, of all people, Howard Dean. And the reason I was thinking of Howard Dean was the famous 2004 Scream.
Scream.
Yeah.
You know, we're gonna go to South Carolina, we're gonna go to Oklahoma, we're gonna go to Arizona, North Dakota, and New Mexico, and California, New York. And that was sort of like it was last night. You know, we're gonna go to Cuba, we're gonna go to Mexico, we're gonna go to Greenland. It seemed to be that same sort of hyped up thing, but to all of your points, that, oh, we have to take that seriously, and it's because we don't know where this is headed, but it does. Like, we've been told all of this, right?
Stephen Miller's wife, mm-hmm, yesterday or the day before, posted a map of Greenland filled in with the stars and stripes, mm-hmm, and with the headline "Coming Soon."
Yeah, there you go. That's very nice. You know what? I thought I visited the last non-contiguous state.
Yeah, right. No. The only.
Yes. Yeah. Libby.
Well, I mean, what everybody said is spot on. I look at this, as you all know, from the purely political point of view. And we have people questioning Trump's mental status. We have people questioning his medical status. We have pictures of him with, swollen ankles and the whole nine yards, right? So people are looking at, some people are looking at that and making hay out of it. This is a very macho thing to do. And it's really, from my perspective, one of the things that play here is to show that he's really a man's man and he's going to do whatever he wants to do because that's what men do, right? And, you know, I've got the world to put it in. And so, you know, one of his statements about, I think it was the woman who won the Peace Prize, was so dismissive of her. It was so misogynist. And this is part and parcel to this administration.
She took his prize.
Yeah, right. He hates women in that misogynistic kind of way. And we're seeing that being played out on the international scene with the way he's dealing with these women who are in charge. Threatening Sheinbaum, right, in Mexico, right? Threatening her. I mean, it's really... Also, arresting Maduro's wife, I mean, really? I mean, what does she really have to do with all of this? You know, so it's his macho ethic of, I'm a man, I can do whatever I want. This whole issue now of Greenland and all the other countries, it's like, I'm sorry, but they're a sovereign nation, and they haven't done anything to us. So what is Greenland about?
I think it is about something. I think he has to say he's going after Greenland next because he has to get out of this sphere of influence. Because really what he's done in a sense is say to Putin and to Xi, we're going to go back to a sphere of influence world and this is our hemisphere. And if he stays in that lane, it totally diminishes. You know, if you're talking about the machismo here, it totally diminishes U.S. place in the world. This is worse than Kissinger and Nixon and détente. When you're going to lift the Soviets and the Chinese up to be problem solvers with you, this is, we're not even going to look at Taiwan or I failed in Ukraine to bring a peace. Right.
So we're going to take over another country.
So he has to have over the horizon places.
Let me mention one thing about Greenland, too, and put it in with Canada. And, you know, I love maps. I think it's, I make sure my students study maps and geography still matters in our world. And if you look at just the normal map that we all look at of Greenland, you might wonder, well, what is this all about? But if you look at a globe and you look at it from the top and you look down on that globe and you see the Arctic, which has always been important but is increasingly important as more sea lanes appear through climate change, and you see that along that Arctic area is Russia, Greenland, and Canada. And this is not random by Donald Trump that when he came into office, he was already on about Canada and the 51st state and all the crazy things that he said about it, or Greenland and the crazy things he's now saying about that. I think this has everything to do with what you were saying, Bob, and with the geostrategic center point of the Arctic.
I agree with you. But what's really interesting to me about the Arctic in this situation, and China claims itself as an Arctic country, is that the United States has let its presence in the Arctic Council, you know,
evaporate.
It's not there, and we are so far behind in all of the kind of things that you need to do, have icebreakers. Everything that you can think of to be a player in the Arctic. Yeah, well, so I agree with you, Jim. It's classic Trump. I'm going to say this, I'm going to think this, but I'm not going to do anything about actually being able to manifest.
Right. I mean, the Russian Federation has 22 icebreakers. Yeah. The U.S. has 2.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, this was one of the reasons why Trump was so keen to get into some kind of economic agreement with the Russian Federation in order to exploit some of those resources, you know, both in the Russian Federation and some of the free waters of the Arctic. However, let me point out that what, according to what we know about that, you know, agreement that, which hasn't, you know, been signed yet between between the Russian Federation and the U.S., the U.S. would get just scraps off the table of whatever resources the Russian Federation has. I think very quickly, I just want to point out one other dimension of this, which is rare earth minerals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is very important because Trump sees it as being essential to the development, further development of AI in the U.S. And in its, you know, economic and tech war with China. And so I think that's something that's motivating both Trump's push into Greenland and into Ukraine, which is rich in those minerals as well.
But I just want to say one thing, too. I'm not sure that what Trump really wants in the Arctic is for the U.S. to be taking. I think, and Alexander, this is your area of expertise. Mm. I would love to hear more about this. Mm. I think this has more to do with backdoor deals with the Russians on various other things. And so to neutralize NATO along the Arctic, but to get something else somewhere else, I think, is in play.
I mean, after all, Denmark is a NATO country. And, you know, this could be, you know, entrance of U.S. personnel, you know, military personnel onto Greenland.
We've already got them there.
We already have them there. They've always been there. But, you know, what Trump is discussing is something really quite different. It's really a complete takeover of the territory.
Yeah.
This would essentially be a kind of a wedge, you know, drawn between the U.S. and other NATO countries, which could precipitate the exit of the U.S. from the NATO alliance.
Exactly.
You know, and I think that this is, you know, Trump does have that in mind. I think another aspect of this to think about is that, well, how can I put this?
you can just say it.
Yeah, I can say it. I mean, speaking from kind of like the, you know, the Soviet and Russian perspective, there is this sense of, you know, colonialism, what's driving colonialism is extraction, you know. And this is actually a specific, M. Gessen, who writes for the New York Times and who's an LGBTQ and human rights activist. What they wrote yesterday, you know, and they're Russian. I mean, you know, they spent their initial years in the Soviet Union. She, in her article yesterday, she groaned audibly, practically, of having to sit through Soviet era, you know, geography classes, being lectured at about this country, this region is important precisely because of its useful, extractable resources. Полезные ископаемые, you know, and this is like a kind of like a frozen term in Russian political lexicon, even now, after the Soviet Union has been out of the picture for a while. And what drives this concept is really wherever we see or perceive or find resources that are useful for our country, they're ours to take. As I said, we will take them, we will kill them when we want to.
It's manifest destiny, right?
Yeah,
it's the Monroe Doctrine. It's
the Donroe Doctrine.
Donroe Doctrine. Right. It's all of these things that we all learned in social studies to bear.
But one other thing about the Donroe Doctrine, if you look at the original of the Monroe Doctrine, which had, you know, a kind of a colonialist dimension of it, also had an anti-colonialist dimension because it was specifically directed at whatever aspirations France or Britain would have within the Americas. Mm. And it was basically trying to say, no, you can't take any more of that.
Right. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we have a lot of letters. We have a lot more to talk about as well. We'll do both. We welcome you. If you have not written to us yet and you would like to, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. And we'll continue our discussion on these very important topics on this Monday morning. We welcome you. We'll be right back after this. ¶¶ right. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Robert Brigham, Jim Ketterer, Alexander Mihailovich, and Libby Post making up our group this morning. We welcome you to the discussion. All right, so let's go to a couple of letters, and then we'll continue to the discussion on other things. I think this will bring us to some other issues that people have in mind and want to know about. We go to Desi, who writes, are we having a George Bush, the U.S. invades Panama war, or do you think Germany invades Poland moment, or both, or neither?
Germany invades Poland, I would say. You know, it's ethnic and racial eminent and sort of, you know, nationalistic eminent domain, it seems to me. Yeah.
And what does that say about the possible outcome?
I'll have to pass that on to somebody else. You know, to be honest, I'm not sure. You know, there are all sorts of imponderables. I will say that, you know, it's important for us not to be too sentimental about, you know, American, you know, principles or values. You know, yes, this is, you know, he went through with this, you know, incursion without congressional approval. However, the War Powers Resolution Act of 1973 allows for a chief executive in the United States to send in troops without congressional approval for up to a month. So there are all sorts of murky areas of sort of, you know, American constitutional thinking and theory, you know, in terms of application.
Can I also, Joe, you just asked something that Colin Powell said is the most unasked question ever in Washington, which is, and then what?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
And as Bob was saying at the top of the show, if only American presidents would learn from history, he'd be out of a day job. But I don't know, Bob, that might be worth it.
It might be worth it.
The you know, the euphoria now when I heard the general giving his briefing at the press conference on how the operations happened. Yes, our military is highly adept at being able to do this, and they're very well trained and very well resourced. But that's tactics in search of a strategy, and what is the longer term strategy? And then the other thing that is often the Washington gap is to link strategy to capacity. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that even if we were to have a coherent plan, which we haven't heard yet, but if we were to have, we, the United States, to have a coherent plan in Venezuela, would we have the capacity to actually implement it? You know, this is a very large country. A lot of it is jungle territory. We have armed militias, gangs, organized crime. We have a fractured opposition. We have probably a fractured ruling party. We have Cuban intelligence all over the country, and they're very good and difficult to deal with, and on and on and on. We don't have the on-the-ground knowledge. We don't have the resources. We don't have the capacity, and we certainly don't have the patience to be able to do whatever comes next. So you ask the right question, and there's just no answer.
I mean, that patience is such a part of this, isn't it? And we never seem to have that patience.
Well, I have one example. What are the goals?
Very quickly, I'll just, you know, jump in here. What are the goals of this, you know, this abduction of Maduro and his wife? I think that the whole question of what comes after has to play into what were the initial justifications or intentions of this act. Because let's face it, for starters, the nationalization of oil in Venezuela precedes Maduro. Right. This happened in stages in post-World War II Venezuelan history. The most significant dates were 1976 and 2007 in terms of those resources getting more fully nationalized. But they're not completely nationalized. But it precedes his administration. So that's one thing. The other thing is that Maduro's role and the role of his party in international drug trafficking is minimal. right? Tren de Aragua only has, tenuous links to some members of Maduro's party, but Maduro's party is not driving that, drug trafficking. Furthermore, the drug trafficking that we see coming from Venezuela is primarily cocaine, and it's going to Europe, right? Fentanyl, which is like the really the most genuinely, sort of concerning aspect of drug trafficking in terms of its impact upon the American populace, is coming primarily, through across the Mexican border, and has nothing to do with Venezuela.
And can I just say, just want to jump in quickly,
sure.
The U.S. intelligence agency found in April, they did a finding across all of our many elements of the intelligence community in the U.S. government, and they found exactly what Alexander was talking about, that there are no real noteworthy and sustained links between the Maduro government and the drug trafficking community. That's our own intelligence community that said that in April
but the
of
thing,
2025.
The thing is that we're all sitting here, we all read, some of us more than others can recite all the history and all that sort of stuff. These people don't care. They don't care if Maduro was involved with nationalizing oil in Venezuela, 10 years ago, or whatever it was, a few decades ago. They don't care. They see this. Trump sees this as this is all about oil. It had nothing to do with drugs. We all know that. But this is about returning what the United States and actually his oil-owning cronies, the rich, the oligarchs, right, put into Venezuela, and it was taken away from them. So we're going to go in and get it back. And that's really what this is about, and it's about lining people's pockets. Joe said it before. It's not even going to be trickle-down. It's not even going to be a drip down, right? The rank and file of the United States is not going to see the money coming into their pockets about this. And MAGA, his movement, is not happy. Marjorie Taylor Greene yesterday on Meet the Press, I watched it, and she was like, some of the stuff that was coming out of her mouth is the stuff that's coming out of my mouth, right? But then there's all other kinds of stuff that I would never say that she does say. But she is endemic of where MAGA is on this, because America First to them meant no incursions in other countries, no putting our boots on the ground in other countries, none of our kids being killed and that's what's going to happen. It's going to be a war for oil.
So two quick things. First of all, when I was on the plane, I was talking to my wife, and I turned to her and I said, well, one good thing about all of this, and there are no good things about this, but one good thing is that at least we don't have to hear a CNN story about how to keep your New Year's resolutions. I just looked up on the screen the science behind sticking with your New Year's resolutions. So I'm mad. But it did take them until January 5th to do that. The other thing, Bob, and I know there's other things you want to address here too, but just when we were talking about this idea of talking about the drugs and where this all comes from, but the president last night said, okay, Mexico, get your act together. Well, what are we going to do about that? I mean, how seriously do we take that?
I think all of this is going to have a very short turnaround. I mean, I think part of Trump's calculation here was for the midterms. He loves to go out on the stump and say that gas is below $2 a gallon, which
it's
isn't
not
anywhere.
Right.
But in the best case scenario, in a global market where oil prices have fallen 20% in the last year, if Chevron can increase production, if these companies can increase production, there is going to be a surplus of oil. Demand globally is still consistent, but it's dropping. 50% of Chinese cars sold this year were EVs. So there's a horizon in which demand for oil plunges. Mm. There's also a horizon here where American oil companies are not going to invest at the level Trump thinks they are to reclaim their market share. It's been two decades. This equipment has atrophied. To get $1 billion a day, which is a projected goal out of Venezuela, is going to cost $7 billion. What company in this political environment is going to do that? So I think that once again, the United States has no political corollary to its overwhelming military power. We can do anything we want militarily, but running a country in a global economy where demand is going to decrease and supply is increasing, this is a perfect storm. Well, this is not going to be pretty at all.
Trump thinks he says it and it'll get done.
Yeah, he's wrong.
I know.
He's
well, we all know that. But this is the kind of person we're dealing with in the White House.
I want to go back to something Jim said earlier about the international order, and I agree with him completely. I think this has deep historic roots. And in this region, in 1986, the United States was brought before the International Court of Justice, which is the court that adjudicates issues like interventions like this, military interventions. And it was brought before the ICJ in 1986 for mining Nicaraguan harbors and for funding the Contras. The ICJ found the United States guilty and demanded it pay reparations. The United States' response to that was to unsign the compulsory agreement of membership for the International Criminal or for the International Court of Justice, which means now that we're going to these old 1989 legal White House briefings that never even saw a court to legitimize a kinetic action in support of an arrest warrant. So there's no Congress, even there's no ICJ, there's no UN, there's nothing. There's nothing. It's done. The international order is over as far as Trump is concerned.
All right. I'm just going to throw out a question, and then we're going to go to a break. When we come back, we'll try to answer it. And that is, I heard this all weekend long, and the New York Times did an editorial on it. David Sanger wrote about it extensively, about the illegal nature of this, how this is illegal. Mm-hmm. Pause. And nothing will happen. Nothing will become of it. And I'd like to talk about that a little bit, as well as get to all of the letters that we have. We have many. We'll add yours to the pile. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after news with Ray Kraft. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Let me reintroduce the panel to you. Robert Brigham is here, professor of history and international relations at Vassar College. Jim Ketterer joins us, senior fellow at Bard Center for Civic Engagement. Alexander Mihailovich, professor emeritus of Russian at Hofstra University, currently at Middlebury College, and political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We are talking, of course, about Venezuela and the aftermath. What is next? What is happening now? And what all of this means in so many different aspects and so many different angles, and we're trying to address as many as we possibly can in the time we have. I would like to throw in some letters here as well. Bob writes us from Albany, roundtable only mentions neocon with Iraq, regime change war, and Trump regime change war of Venezuela for oil corporate profits. Please acknowledge Obama and Biden regime change wars in Syria and Libya for oil corporate profits. Just another American administration that needs to be sent to The Hague for crimes against humanity. Does anybody want to comment on that?
I would say, Libya is a perfect example of the failure to ask and then what, and to have a good answer to that, because that country is still in horrible situation and chaos following the intervention by NATO in 2011, 2012. And so there were also so much talk then about how the oil was going to do something. Syria, I think, is a very different case. I disagree with the letter writer in that case, and I wouldn't put that in that same category.
Yeah, I have to agree. Syria, you know, much of the Obama administration's, you know, largely ineffective, you know, policy in regard to Syria had to do with dislodging Assad and, you know, these rather fundamental human rights violations, and the outsized Russian presence in Syria.
You know, I also just, if I can just add on to that, I think one thing I'm hearing in response to this Venezuela intervention is the idea that the United States should never intervene anywhere, that it always turns out poorly. And I think that can also be problematic. Number one, I've lived in countries that are serious authoritarian regimes, and I've had many, many, many conversations with people who say we the people in this country have no power to throw off this regime. We're living under it for many decades, for many lifetimes, and we need some kind of outside assistance. Can't you, the United States, do something to assist us in this? And if we look at some, you know, examples, number one, the big example of not intervening was Rwanda. This led ultimately to the idea that there is a responsibility to protect that transcends state sovereignty. Unfortunately, that R2P was used as a justification for the intervention in Libya, and I think has been tainted since then. But I just want to—I'll just add my own personal experience with an intervention where I was on the ground, and I think is a model. It wasn't perfect, but for some things that had to be done, and I think went largely right and continues to. And that is Kosovo, 1999, 2000. Mm-hmm. And so in that case, you know, there were, you know, striking human rights violations by the leadership in Belgrade. There was a long series of diplomatic engagement by professional diplomats, Richard Holbrooke taking the lead, but not just Holbrooke. There was coordination with Congress. There was coordination with our allies. There were serious investigations for for war crimes violations, and eventually Milosevic ended up in the International Criminal Tribunal in The Hague. But we did intervene. We did use the United States military. We did bomb Belgrade. And we did put combat troops on the ground in Kosovo. They are still there. Joe, you were asking about patience. Kosovo is an example of patience. 25, 26 years on now, we still have the NATO troops there. We still have the United Nations involved there. And we have the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which I was working for, and that's what sent me there. Involved, and this takes a lot of professional diplomacy to make this work, to sustain it, to have it be valuable. I'm not saying it's a perfect example, and I'm not saying it's all worked out perfectly well, but to say we should never intervene anywhere, we should never use this kind of power that Bob says we have for the purposes that were used in Kosovo, I think is the wrong lesson to take from this case in Venezuela.
Let's go back to the letters from our listeners. We go to Stephanie. Happy New Year, esteemed panelists. Please discuss the impact of America's takeover of Venezuela on the citizens there and how they will manage through this chaos, especially those with limited resources. I thank you for your insights.
It's going to be very difficult because, you know, I think we've already seen on the streets as panelists have already mentioned, there's confusion. No one wants to raise their head too much because you're not entirely sure what the next political step is going to be. How do you reintegrate the tens of thousands of people who've left and who have been in limbo since the sanctions regime has taken care of? There's 30,000 Colombian troops on the border trying to protect that border. I mean, I think this is going to get a lot worse before it gets better, and the people who are going to pay for it are the people on the ground in Venezuela.
And we're going to be at war. Let's just be honest about this. He has been itching to declare war because it's, you know, it's the manly thing to do. And I think we will be at war within Venezuela. We will have more people, boots on the ground. We'll have American deaths. His MAGA will splinter. And this really, in a sense, helps the Democrats in 2026.
I agree with you, but I also just, there's this, the narrative.
You can't believe this.
Well, there's the narrative that's been going on within the Trump administration and as he was running of, you know, we're going to end wars, not start wars. We're going to end wars, mm-hmm. not start wars. We're going to end wars, not start wars. And I God knows I don't want to get into the mind of Donald Trump, but it does seem as though, I mean, at some point, I think he believes that of we're not going to start wars, but he also doesn't think that what he's going to do will actually start a war, right. which is the scariest part.
Right.
Right.
He doesn't really understand foreign policy. He doesn't understand how political power is really used in an international setting like this. He doesn't respect any of the international norms. The idea that the United States would leave NATO mm-hmm. is really scary. It's very, very scary because, as one of you guys said, it sets it up for U.S., Russia, China hegemony.
Well, this is kind of the fantasy of the far right, you know, globally, mm-hmm. that of this sort of so-called multipolar world where you have, you know, different empires, you know, some of them former colonial empires, you know, ensconced in their sort of so-called sphere of influence. I mean, this is the whole theory behind the Russian propaganda, you know, push for the so-called Russian world. Russian world includes all of those territories that mm-hmm. were formerly a part, not just of the Soviet Union, but even the pre-1917 Russian Empire. So that's one, you know, component of it. I think another aspect of this we need to sort of bear in mind is like the whole history of the term America First. And this came from, you know, the isolationist movement, you know, on the eve of American intervention in Europe during World War II. And the thing to bear in mind about it is that the theory that was underlining it, it was essentially something very much like a multipolar world. You know, let Germany do whatever it wants. Mm-hmm. Its sphere of influence, legitimate sphere of influence, are those German-speaking territories in Czechoslovakia and Poland. They belong in Germany. Mm-hmm. All right. So, yes, we are not going to intervene. We are not going to get involved in a war. But it's fine if Germany wants to, you know, invade those areas of those two countries because that is a legitimate concern of their own. It's a form of Germany First. I mean, so much of the American First movement was basically bolstered up by the German-American Bund. You mm-hmm. know, so I think that history we need to sort of bear in mind. They're not against the idea of intervention, but it has to be an intervention of a particular kind.
In a particular place.
In too. A particular place.
Right.
I think the Trump administration is a little reluctant to have to go to Congress. Right now, on the legal standpoint, I mean, clearly this is a violation of Article 2, Section 4 of the UN Charter. U.S. Constitution makes all ratified treaties the law of the land. We've ratified the UN treaty, so we should be following it. However, lawyers have been very successful arguing that the president lawfully can override the limits placed on U.S. force abroad. And so they want to be in that place. They want to be in that place where the lawyers are saying when Maduro says in court today or whenever he will say it and pleads not guilty, and his lawyers are going to argue that the United States had no right to intervene in a sovereign state, that the FBI has the power to arrest because there's a fugitive from U.S. criminal justice. And this is a kinetic action in support of a warrant. It's not a war. If this escalates above where it is right now, then you get out of this very comfortable legal situation. U.S. Supreme Court has never, ever ruled on a U.N. charter question. It doesn't want to.
No, mm-hmm. they won't.
And they won't. Mm-hmm. So I think Trump might have just enough political savvy to think he knows where the end line is here so he doesn't have to go get a declaration of war from Congress, because I don't think he'd get one.
I mean, I was reading the New York Times, the editorial board opinion in the Times on Saturday, right after this happened and shortly after the president spoke. And the whole point was about this is illegal, this is illegal, this is illegal. But it doesn't
matter.
Really, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. As long as it stays here.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think that Declaration of War is probably setting the bar too high for any American president post 1941. I mean,
but even a war resolution, authorization
of use
a war resolution from
military
this,
force. Yeah.
He's
AUMF.
Not going to get it from this Congress.
I think you're right, and I think he knows that. By the way, the lawyer who wrote that
Bill Barr
was Bill Barr, 1989. He was assistant attorney general at the time in the George H.W. Bush administration,
and it was just for. That was an internal argument just for the White House. It never went to court. I mean, this is the argument. This is why they don't want to, I think, pop this up to something that's really going to see the light of day.
Yeah. The other interesting thing is that I'm assuming that Maduro's lawyers will argue that he's a head of state and has immunity. And now they're going to say he's an illegitimate head of state. But interesting in that, you know, this is the American president is one who is very happy to have his own, you know, own immunity and to use it at every turn. And then to deny the immunity of another head of state will be an interesting day in court. Mm.
More letters. We go to Tim. Would the panel please mention how the BRICS countries are... take two. Would the panel please mention how the BRICS countries and their replacement of the dollar might be part of Trump's move on Venezuela?
Yeah, this is an I think it's a really interesting question.
Yeah.
And I'm going to take just a little part of it and then pass it off. But Venezuela owes China so much money. And they were billions. And they were not able to pay it, so they were paying with oil. Well, now what are they going to do? China was, you know, that was where Venezuelan oil, besides Cuba, was going. Well, now they don't have that. So I think China's role in all of this is really good. In 3 weeks, we're going to be talking about China, I think, on this issue more than anybody else. And so I think, you know, the whole BRICS question is really interesting.
Well, China is very interested, obviously, in sort of the dislodging of the dollar, you know, as kind of like the primary global currency. Yeah. And it is the C in BRICS, you know. And so that's something to bear in mind. Let me point out also that Russia is the R of BRICS, and one of among the five founding nations in 2009 with the establishment of that international alliance, informal alliance. And they're also very keen on seeing American markets kind of decentered from the global market.
Yeah, Donald Trump has brought up BRICS several times. It's clearly on his mind and under his skin. He did also accuse Spain of being a member of it, which is not true. Yeah. But that aside, it's clearly on his mind.
Let's go back to letters from our listeners. This one from Eric. I thought there were safeguards in place to keep U.S. presidents from going crazy and just waging war on any country for any reason. Cuba, Colombia, Greenland? Which country is next, and when will it be stopped?
See, I think that, like everything, the terminology is what's really important here. He's not waging war. This was a kinetic action in support of a standing indictment. Mm. And in that language, he can do this one-off, but that's what I'm trying to suggest. He can't go much higher than that without getting a war resolution from Congress. And everyone in Congress that watches these things carefully says it's not going to happen.
But, they have I think the administration has a real difficulty, and I agree with Libby, I don't think they care, but I'll point out the difficulty anyway. If they're really going to double down on this law enforcement justification for the intervention, then what is the justification for the continued attacks on small vessels off the coast? Because if that is a law enforcement action, there's been no due process whatsoever. If it's a military action, then there's all the other things that you talked about, Bob, that should come into play. What is it? Why is it continuing? What is both the legal foundation for it, and what is the strategy?
I think there's a good and interesting point that Jim's making, and this is just exemplifies the confusion of the Trump administration. They purposefully came out and said this is a blockade. Well, a blockade
is an act of war.
Act of war.
Right.
But your military incursion is not. It's in search of a warrant. It is strategic confusion all over the place.
Rubio has used the word quarantine multiple times in the past few days.
Trying to get them on their same page.
Right.
But it's, that genie's already out of the bottle.
Yeah.
And you never know. They might say, well, we're going to continue to blow those small boats out of the water because they're really coming to rescue Maduro.
Yeah.
You never know.
I think we just attacked one yesterday.
Yeah, I had heard that.
Yeah.
Okay, Alexander, this question I'm going to send your way. Ray says, what example does this set for China with Thailand or Russia with Ukraine? Everyone has been given a new example.
Well, the new example, I mean, there's a lot of circularity here in terms of the way in which the Trump administration and the Putin administration have kind of, you know, swap theories about territoriality and sovereignty. One of the reasons I think that Trump was so interested in, you know, in Putin was that he articulated, you know, quite clearly and, you know, on its own terms fairly rigorously, this whole idea of sphere of influence, which Trump found very useful for American foreign policy. We take what we want, we kill what we want, we kill, take when we want to, as I said earlier. So that's one aspect. Obviously, the precedent is you know, rather concerning because now not only can Russia fully justify on the basis of this action over the weekend its incursion into Ukraine, but China can justify any, you know, action in regard to Taiwan, which, let me point out, Taiwan does not have diplomatic relations with any country, right? And so it's, you know, its status is you know, very, you know, tenuous, you know, in terms of kind of global recognition. And I, you know, so, yeah, that's what I would say, you know.
Let's go to, does anybody want to add to that? Okay. Let's go to the letters once again. Kiernan says Maduro is currently, take two, Maduro is certainly a, I now have to relearn my job. Maduro is certainly a dictator and a drug trafficker. However, how is this congruent with the non-interventionist and isolationist policy Trump ran on? The so-called anti-war Trump crowd is now beating the war drums. Is it now the responsibility of the United States to administer a country of 30 million people? I am very concerned with what the succession plan is here. The U.S. doesn't seem to be interested in dealing with Machado, the main Democratic opposition leader. To me, this proves that the U.S. seeks to expatriate Venezuelan oil for our profits rather than transitioning Venezuela to a democracy and doing what is best for the Venezuelan people.
So can I also just add a couple other factoids of things that have gone on in the use of military force recently and the threat thereof? One is strikes in Nigeria. And the narrative there is that it's against the Islamic State and associated organizations with the Islamic State and in support and defending Christian population. Now, those organizations in Nigeria are highly problematic, highly dangerous. They've been killing a lot of people. They've abducted 300 just recently after these strikes. But they're equally dangerous to Christians and Muslims and others. But the fact that the U.S. used that force, and then also Donald Trump has threatened to use force in defense of protesters in Iran. And so, you know, part of what that letter writer is bringing up is that, you know, is this part of what he ran on? Of course, it's not. He's not ideological. He's not consistent. But this is something that is clearly above and beyond what is just going on in Venezuela.
Yeah. I'd like to add to this, you know, sort of from the Russian context, what's interesting is that there are similar, similar sort of features, you know, to that foreign policy as well. In 2014, Vladimir Putin justified the incursion of Russian troops, Russian so-called green men, on the basis of the color of their uniforms in Crimea, because he was anticipating a kind of a purge or a genocide of Russian citizens, ethnic Russians in the Crimean Peninsula. And so it was a kind of a human rights crisis that needed to be addressed right away. We see, you know, an anticipation of this in the Crimean War in the 1850s, where Nicholas I justified, you know, going to war with the Ottoman Empire on the basis of the possible extermination of the Christian population of the Crimean Peninsula. So these are kind of opportunistic justifications, you know. And, you know, obviously, I mean, in the case of, you know, the Crimean War in the 19th century, this didn't have anything to do with the Christians and their possible, you know, oppression by the Ottomans. Mm-hmm. What it had to do with was the Russian Empire aspiring to greater, you know, mercantile dominance of the Black Sea. And I would say that the reasons for this are, you know, in terms of, you know, the Russian annexation of Crimea, in 2014 was actually for precisely the same reasons. And we need to sort of view so much of this, it seems to me, from an economic lens. You know, why does Trump want Greenland? Well, he wants these resources. Yeah.
The narratives say one thing, but the reality is something quite different. Yeah.
We have less than a minute, but it's also how these things, I mean, we've been talking about how they do play out, but like Greenland was a big issue and then sort of petered out and wasn't talked about, and now it's back, and that's the nature of this too, where they go dormant for a while, and then somebody lights a match again.
These surgical strikes that Jim is mentioning seem to fit perfectly with the way that Trump thinks. You go do something, and then it's over. But that's not how conflict actually works.
Right.
And
yeah.
I think Libby brought this up earlier, and that is, you know, the fog of war, if this goes beyond a day, you don't know where the conflict will lead. And that's when you get in trouble. You get mission creep. You get all the kind of things that have been U.S. history for the last 60 years.
We still have letters. We still have much more to talk about on this issue. And we will do exactly that as we finish up our time together. We welcome you, panel, at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you all here with us. We have lots to discuss. We're, of course, still talking about Venezuela and the actions this weekend and what is going on. We know that Nicolas Maduro is to appear in court, I believe, around noontime and is just arriving as we speak. And a lot going on, of course, there. In the legal maneuverings, as well as the continued discussions, like the ones we're having, as to what is happening within the country and what the United States' involvement is in all of that. We go to Andy, who says, by the time the Americans do anything of substance to actually stop this corrupt administration, we're going to have such a huge mess to deal with that I don't think I will live to see us even get back to where we were. Where were we?
There's no going
Nobody
back.
Quite knows.
Yeah, no going no back. You always move forward, right?
Yeah. Well, to quote Ray Davies of the Kinks, it's a mixed up, muddled up, shook up world.
Yes, you know? That's right.
I just want to say, I mean, one thing, I mean, just mixed up, muddled up, you know, in terms of even the, like the justifications, like the shifting of the goalposts, you know, also the inconsistency about legal theory coming from the Trump administration, which says on the one hand, via the Department of Homeland Security and ICE, that foreign nationals who live in the U.S. but don't have green cards and are not, you know, citizens here, obviously, that they have no right to legal representation in being, you know, arrested or, you know, put into prison. On the other hand, here you have precisely one of those foreign nationals who is not, you know, an American citizen, who comes from one of those groups that ICE and, you know, Tom Homan insists has no legal rights under the Constitution. All of a sudden, he's being put on trial in Manhattan in what's going to be something like a show, you know, like a show trial. I mean, I find
it's kangaroo court.
It's a kangaroo court, but it has no coherence, you know. And it's going to be very interesting to see, like, the evidentiary search, you know, for that trial when it becomes very clear that his, you know, his ties to global drug trafficking are tangential at best.
I wish we could talk more about the Kinks.
Yeah.
The Kinks, yes, right.
Well, it's not a panel until we can involve the Kinks. Well,
anyway.
So, at the core of what Maduro is being accused of is narco-terrorism. And so he's not the first person in federal court to be accused of this, Pablo Escobar and others. But it's interesting to dig into the language and to particularly how this is being positioned in this particular case. And so there is a long history of terrorist organizations like Al-Qaeda and others who have used drug trafficking as a way to fund themselves. Mm. I wrote an article about it when I was living in Morocco like 25, 26 years ago, and I've gotten more feedback on that article, some good, some not so good. Yeah. This is a tried and true method. But using funds from drug trafficking to support terrorism is different than what this charge is. This charge is that you're using drug trafficking as terrorism. Mm-hmm. That is a very difficult argument to make. I'm going to be really interested to see how the Maduro lawyers respond to that, because it's basically saying, the U.S. government is saying in the indictment that the Maduro government is using drug trafficking as a weapon of war against the United States.
And involved in a conspiracy to accumulate weapons in the process, which again is a very amorphous kind of legal.
Yeah, he's got machine guns.
Right.
Yeah.
Let's go to, did you want to say something?
No.
I didn't want to interrupt. Okay. Let's go to other letters here. We go to Paul, who says, has anyone heard who's getting the $50 million reward for supporting the arrest of Maduro? It appears someone helped the U.S. with inside information.
We had, everything I see says we've had assets on the ground for at least 10 months. There's a lot of training that goes into this kind of extraction. I mean, I do think, and this is right up Libby's alley here, I do think some of this was the wag the dog. This got Epstein files off the front page. If you've been planning this for 10 months, you could have done it next Tuesday.
Yeah.
But over the weekend like this, it did get the Epstein files off. And it got the fact that 20 million Americans no longer have subsidized health care. It got all sorts of things, the affordability issue. It got a lot of things off the front page.
It's a big distraction.
Yeah.
It's the shiny object over here, so you don't pay attention to what's going to bring my presidency down over there.
Rally around the flag.
Right.
Another Paul writes to us and says, Libby is spot on about Trump and his machismo, weak though he is. We men are the disappointment of our species. We men are the bullies throughout time. We men foment wars. We men sacrifice peace and family for personal gain and fame, ever thus.
Well, you know, as they used to say in the classic Saturday Night Live, acting in masculine in a manly manner.
Yes, that's right. be a manly man.
Yeah, be a manly man. But, you know, I think here, you know, this is an example of protesting too much, you know.
To the panel community, writes Oliver, shouldn't the future of Venezuela and its natural resources should be determined by the Venezuelan people, not by money-grubbing U.S. big oil corporate interests? By stating, we're going to run Venezuela, Trump has effectively declared Donald J. Trump and reigning illegitimate Venezuelan dictator. Did Bible-hawking Trump spend a single second enumerating, much less lamenting, the Venezuelan human lives extinguished?
And no, he didn't. But also, to go back to the case that is going to be presented today in court, it's interesting that the United States is not arguing at all about any of the things that the UN has been chronicling about Maduro, which is crimes against humanity. Mm-hmm. Even this year came out with another fact-finding report that was very extensive. Yeah. The U.S. isn't drawing on that at all.
Although I wonder, just a question for you and other panelists, including, you know, I mean, all of us really, some of these so-called other charges that are being leveled against Maduro in New York, might those include some of the human rights violations? I have
Doesn't
no
seem
idea.
Like
it's
it.
Going to be doubtful, because the only way that this indictment stands up is just what Jim said earlier. These have to be crimes committed against America,
right,
and Americans, right, which is why they bring him to Stewart.
And they
in New York,
and they don't care about the human rights violations. Yeah. They really don't.
In fact, I think they specifically don't want to draw upon that because they don't see the United States as being positioned vis-a-vis these international organizations. They don't really see what the United Nations is doing as legitimate.
Yeah. One of the I know one of the contingencies, and of course contingencies are not good measures of anything because there's always a contingency plan going on for everything if there's an elephant on the roof. But one of the contingency plans was getting at political prisoners in this initial surge strike, and
right,
it was quickly discounted, but that goes to the human rights issues. I mean, Venezuela's prisons are filled, mm-hmm, with political prisoners.
Well, and 8 million people have left Venezuela, yeah, for their lives.
Yeah,
I mean, that was one of the questions. There was a 60 Minutes story last night about this, of one of the negotiators who had been working on releasing some of those prisoners. And the question asked was, well, was there any attempt to try to release them? And no. So we continue and we go to this letter, which I think is a good one. The invasion of Venezuela is the precursor for the invasion of Cuba and is very similar to the situation with Russia and Ukraine, and Trump just okayed it. What are your thoughts on that?
I think they're interviewing the future Batista today in the West Wing.
Yeah. I think Marco Rubio is at the center of that next phase.
Yeah, of the 40-plus people who in the president's residence in Caracas who were killed, 32 of them were Cuban security personnel.
Yeah.
So, this is, you know, I think that one thing that they researched very deeply was the involvement of Cuba in sort of, you know, maintaining the security infrastructure of Venezuela, and this would be in some sense a strike against both countries.
All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up the program and we'll get to one or two things that are also making news on this Monday morning. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll return right after this. Well, not surprisingly, there were other things going on over the weekend, and there were talks that were taking place, and we want to talk about that just a little bit in our moments left on the program. And we welcome you to continue to write to us and join us, panel at WAMC.org. Governor Tim Walz of Minnesota said on Monday that he was abandoning his bid for re-election to a third term. And Senator Amy Klobuchar, a fellow Democrat, is considering seeking the office, two people briefed in conversations between the two politicians said. Mr. Walz and Ms. Klobuchar met on Sunday in Minnesota, where he informed her of his plans and she confirmed her interest in running to succeed him. For Mr. Walz, the Democratic nominee for vice president in the 2024 election with Kamala Harris, the departure caps a brief rise in national politics. Mr. Walz said a widening scandal over fraud in social services programs in Minnesota had persuaded him to drop out of the race. Mr. Walz had been criticized for his administration's oversight of the programs and its failure to prevent widespread fraud. I came to the conclusion that I can't give a political campaign my all, Mr. Walz said in a statement. Every minute I spend defending my own personal interests would be a minute I can't spend defending the people of Minnesota against the criminals who prey on our generosity and the cynics who prey on our differences. Mr. Walz has scheduled a news conference for later today where he is expected to discuss his decision. Ms. Klobuchar did not respond to requests for comment on Monday morning. So there is this whole issue about fraud and how that story broke and how it went in the MAGA world around and has been around for a while, and how it is now having impact, obviously, with the governor saying not running for re-election. But the other story here to me is that I think I am not alone in thinking that Amy Klobuchar was one of the people that was expected to run for president in 2028 and thought to be in a somewhat good position to be one of the lead candidates. Libby?
This whole scandal is, for the lack of a better word, trumped up. I mean, I don't think most of it's true. And so he's now got to spend his time debunking a lie, right? And the other part of this is, and he didn't say this, but his family has been attacked. His son, who we all know has developmental delays, has been attacked mercilessly online by the magosphere, which is just a disgusting display of who they really are as people. I mean, I remember when he cried at the convention and people went nuts over that, you know. And so, you know, it's too bad. I think he is a good governor. I think Amy Klobuchar would probably win in Minnesota. And, you know, yes, she could have run for president. I don't think she could have won. But we also need to shore up Democratic governors across the country as a bulwark against Trump and his policies. And so this would keep Minnesota in Democratic hands.
I think Walz's statement about why he's bowing out has to be regarded as not being an acknowledgement of the legitimacy of these fraud allegations, which are completely fabricated. And I should point out, deeply racist.
Yes.
This is all about supposedly the malfeasance of the Somali community.
Right. And this this shows that this man values democracy and the job he's doing over protecting himself and protecting his job. You know what I mean? I mean, he's dropping out because of these lies and what he's going to have to do to push back on them, and he's sacrificing his political career for that. And that's laudable. It really is.
But Libby, do you imagine that Donald Trump will take a victory lap now and
he pushed
out Tim Walz, et cetera?
Of course he will. You know, that's just who he is. He is a disgusting human being. So, I mean, I might get in trouble for saying that, but it's true. I mean, we see it over and over and over again. What he does is only self-serving. How much money he and his family are making out of the presidency, it's disgusting. And this Supreme Court's not going to do anything because they're all his puppets, the majority of them anyway.
I mean, I'm a little bit concerned about what I hear occasionally from the left in this country, where they say things like, "Well, okay, Trump is corrupt, but at least he's honest about it." You know,
that's
the fig leaf is off. The fig leaf is off. American policy has always been deeply corrupt. He's simply telling it as it is, which is also, you know, a phrase that turns up, you know, globally in the far right. You know, so and so, this or that character. Person is saying what you're already thinking, but you know most people don't want to openly acknowledge, but they are. So anyway,
from a political standpoint, that's one of the interesting things to me about this Venezuela incursion, is that whatever your dog whistle was, Trump was your person. The only lines you couldn't cross, the only red lines, were pedophilia and forever wars.
And he's crossed them both. Oops.
What about Tim Walz? I'm interested in the story because the fraud story has been out there for a while, and now it's really hit. And so, is there something there, and or do we take him at his word that? I mean, to what Libby said, that you know there's the attacks on his family, but also you know just enough is enough, and I don't need this anymore.
I think there's an underlying thing here that rarely gets talked about, and that is that Minnesota leads the country in social services.
Yeah.
You know, it's the place you want to be if you need a helping hand at a time in your life. So it has a massive social service program so that there may be some fraud or corruption in it at some times. That's not unheard of. But I do think that Waltz was a big part of continuing Minnesota's long reign as one of the best places to be for social services.
I mean, I think there might be, I think from what I've read up on this issue in Minnesota is that much of it has to do with mismanagement. It's not necessarily or only rarely, very rarely active fraud or misappropriation of funds. I think that's a really important distinction. And, you know, getting back, I mean, it's interesting that many of these social services that are being, you know, targeted as being corrupt are, you know, have to do with child care. And, it's, you know, this also kind of feeds into the sort of like the hard right narrative of, you know, about pedophilia and sort of like the victimization of children, even though the specific, matter of pedophilia is not being brought up here, but I just want to remind people about that whole panic in the 1980s and the early 1990s in American political culture about, the mistreatment, supposed mistreatment of children and, as a kind of a widespread phenomenon.
Walls launched his bid for a third term in September, but in recent weeks has been facing a barrage of incoming political fire from President Trump and Republicans and some Democrats over the large-scale theft in a state that has long prided itself on good governance. More than 90 people, most from Minnesota's large Somali community, have been charged since 2022 in what has been described as the nation's largest COVID-era scheme. How much money has been stolen through alleged money laundering operations involving fraudulent meal and housing programs, daycare centers, and Medicaid services is still being tabulated, but the attorney in Minnesota said the scope of the fraud could exceed $1 billion and rise to as high as $9 billion, and that according to Fox News.
Uh-huh. Okay. You know, and I think this has just been an opportunity for the Trump administration to double down on the targeting of certain groups, as Alexander said, you know, the ethnic and racial aspects to this play as part of a broader narrative that has been constructed nationwide, and the questions about, like, well, who's really truly an American, who deserves to be an American, and, you know, who's involved in, like, these, you know, these horrible fraudulent cases.
Right.
It is also an opportunity for Donald Trump to specifically target one of his consistent critics, Ilhan Omar.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's taken this to the bank.
And, you know, it's so interesting. Here's a man who's bankrupted how many companies? And talking about fraud, financial fraud.
Yeah. This is all. There's also a kind of, he's using this as a Trojan horse for addressing the whole matter of birthright citizenship.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You know, which the Supreme Court is going to hear fairly soon. 80% of the Somalis who live in Minnesota are American citizens. So, but yet, you know, that majority is somehow not legit. You know, it's very murky reasoning, to say the least.
Yeah, and they've, in addition to the birthright issue, there's a very strong push from the administration to up the number of people they denaturalize every year. So people who've gone through the naturalization process, they say, well, you've done this fraudulently. You know, if you've been fraudulent on this issue, maybe you've been fraudulent in your naturalization case as well. And, you know, so to who knows what the numbers really end up at. But to put that up as, you know, example number one of fraudulent people who really don't deserve to be here, this seems to be the target group of the moment.
But denaturalizing is a very cumbersome process, and you have to sort of really, you know, provide all sort of documentation indicating, like, that this was falsified, that was falsified. If you go directly to the Supreme Court and you make a birthright citizenship,
right,
a kind of, a, you know, like a new sort of referendum or discussion about it, that kind of, you know, sort of is a sort of a shortcut or a workaround, the whole matter of denaturalizing, you know, this or that person or this or that community.
Will it have a domino effect? Because I'm second generation. right?
Yeah, I'm first. I'm first generation, right. so my goose is cooked.
Yeah.
Anyway,
but it's true. That's the thing. You know, will it have that kind of domino effect where they're really going to look at where people they don't like came from? My grandparents came over on the boat.
Just listen again. Yeah, it's an excellent question, Libby. I mean, listen again to J.D. Vance's speech at the Republican convention. Mm-hmm. You know, only people who have been here for multiple generations, you know, are deemed to be, according to him, you know, legitimate Americans or real Americans.
Except for Native Americans.
Except for Native. Well, that's a whole other discussion.
Yeah, right.
But also, you know, the other thing, of course, is just the whole spike in after, for example, Obama's election, in terms on the internet, a spike of usage of terms on the internet such as 14th Amendment Americans, as if they are not real Americans, as people who preceded the 14th Amendment.
Right. We are out of time. My thanks to Alexander Mihailovich, Libby Post, Jim Ketter, and Robert Brigham. Thank you all very much for talking on this very newsy day. We'll be back right after this.